Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
Hello, and thank you so much for downloading. It's great to be with you, and have I got a great show for you this week. I'm actually in the Financial Times offices, the first time I've recorded a podcast here, and nobody knows I'm here. I turned up and persuaded someone to let me in, and I'm going to interview two fabulous people. One of them, Stefan Stern, is a former colleague of ours here and is also a fellow columnist on the appointment section, and is, more importantly for this purpose, the director of the High Pay Centre. And my other guest is Natalie Jackman, who works for Mercer and is, interestingly, a business psychologist who knows all about how to negotiate a pay rise. Together, we're going to be discussing pay. How can you get more of it? Should you be asking for more of it? How should you be putting your case and your argument? And finally, is there a disconnect these days between what people are paid and what they actually deliver? With all those things in mind, let's get started. Natalie, tell us a little bit to start with about Mercer, because a lot of people won't know much about Mercer, and it's very involved with pay, isn't it?
Pay is at the core of what Mercer does. We advise the top 250 companies in the UK around pay issues, about 80% of them. So what a lot of companies are realizing is that it's moving away from the pure financial components of pay, and that it's becoming more important to get the deal right with their employees.
My argument has always been that if you want a pay rise, but you work in a company that can't afford it, but you don't want to leave the company because you like working there and it gives you the opportunity to do the things you want to do, then you should find another way for them to give you a pay rise that isn't necessarily financial.
The creativity on both sides is really important. So on the employer side, obviously on the employee side, I've coached and mentored a lot of people over the years. I've got my personal experience around successful and less successful pay negotiations. and it's a really complex spectrum. If you feel you're not being paid enough, you need to start with doing your homework and first of all figuring out why do you feel you're not paid enough. But sometimes we feel something isn't quite right in this deal. I'm putting in too much compared to what I get out. And sometimes that's not just about pay. And I found that a lot of those moments where there is tension in the system, where the employee doesn't quite feel that they're treated right, a lot of that can be resolved with a proper conversation. And it's amazing the things that sometimes surface that dissolve that tension that sometimes haven't got anything to do with money, but something's underlying where, you know, where there is something else that's really important to you. And sometimes it's not that easy to get to that point.
And if you were advising somebody preparing for that conversation, so say I wasn't happy with what I was putting in versus what I was getting out, and I managed to actually get someone to arrange to have a conversation with me, which is the first step, how would you advise me to prepare for that conversation?
There is the factual preparation, so you need some data points that you need to be clear on for yourself. So the market value of your skill set is really important. Obviously, you can get that by having conversations in the market with your network. For an individual, first point of call is most probably a trusted recruiter that can give you a good indication. What we find from advising companies that there is about a 15 to 20% differential between a recruiter perspective and the benchmark, the medium benchmark that we would provide to a company. And that's easy to explain because obviously when you jump jobs, you know, there is usually a premium of about 15 to 20%.
I would always tell someone not to move unless there was a 20% premium.
Yeah.
And particularly women, because women can get things done so much more easily in an environment where they're known and trusted and can operate. So to move outside of the familiar and have to build all your new internal network somewhere else, I think needs at least a 20% premium.
Absolutely. And you know what's interesting to that point of, we see that the concept of pay is completely, you know, starting to turn on its head. We have the millennials and other employee groups that are telling us pay is no longer really the key factor for them to consider a move. So what we see is that companies can actually save about 50% of that premium by offering other components of the deal that are more attractive to people than pay historically was. Well, there is a big opportunity for companies to look at this question of how do we structure the deal for people differently. I had some successful negotiations over my career, but also some horrid ones.
And looking back at the ones that weren't so successful in your personal career, this would almost count as an irreverent question, yeah, actually. Yeah. Why were they unsuccessful?
Where I did worst was where I wanted it most badly. I just wanted that job because it just, and coming back to the deal, it felt like this will allow me to do what I'm burning for. This will allow me to do what I'm really, really passionate about. They are the moments where maybe women more often than men, statistics show it, there's a massive gap. I think 57%, according to Sheryl Sandberg, Lean In book, I think 57% of men negotiate hard when they enter 7% of women. So I mean,
what are the kind of things that people are asking for that aren't money? This podcast will be listened to by people who manage people and have to recruit people. Yes. You know, what kinds of things should they be looking at as a way of attracting people and paying people in a way that isn't money?
Yeah. It's becoming less and less predictable what is important to people. Yes, there are themes. You know, millennials are telling us roughly it is about purpose. I want to have meaning in my work. I want to grow. I want to go somewhere where I can do good in the world. So that's certainly a theme. But what we also find that within all of those groups, there are huge differences. What's important really for managers is to find out what is important to that particular person that's sitting across the table here. And then hopefully you are working in it for a company that allows you to apply some flexibility in terms of what you give to that person. So work-life balance, one topic. You know, if you are able to provide a work environment that really doesn't care where people do their work, that's has huge currency for people and can really cut the premium that your competitor might need to pay because they can't offer that flexibility.
Well, at this point, I'd love to bring in Stefan. You have recently taken a job which puts you at the forefront of talking about pay. Tell us about that.
Since the autumn, I've been at the High Pay Centre, the think tank which looks at, well, the clue is in the name, what we would regard as excessive pay at the top of some businesses and organisations.
This disparity between the pay at the top and the pay at the bottom has really only come to the critical attention of people in relatively recent years. And we had the shareholder spring in 2012. 20 years ago, this wasn't seen as an issue, was it? And why is that?
Well, something has happened gradually. I mean, it's a systemic problem. And as you know from your systems thinking, we can't fiddle with one little bit of a system. It's got lots of elements to it, and we have to look at it in the round. But bit by bit, gradually, and only noticed every so often, like in 2012, and noticed initially, of course, with Cedric Brown of British Gas 20 years ago, when an enormous pay rise happened at the privatisation. It's happened gradually. Everyone involved in the system has sort of acquiesced in it. And so bit by bit, yes, 20 years ago, the average ratio of the top to the middle, probably about 40 times or so, 40 or 50 times. A big ratio by historic standards, but not outrageous, not outlandish. Today, we see more like 180 times in the FTSE. Wages, as we know, certainly the last 10 years, for most of us, for most people, been pretty flat. So that gap, those graphs, the lines part, and the ratio have got bigger and bigger and bigger. And it's happened bit by bit, round the table in the system, with REMCOs and boards, with pay consultants, dare I say with headhunters as well, part of the process. There's no one in, and the asset managers, of course, the shareholders themselves, there's no one actually in the process who's really saying formally, firmly, assertively, come off it, too much. I know this does happen occasionally, privately, we don't get to hear about it. So there's partly a PR and comms problem with these numbers that emerge. We don't hear when REMCOs or boards have turned down CEO applicants because they're asking for too much. I think companies should be much braver on that point. They'd get fantastic PR, I think. Some investor relations people say, oh God, they got their third choice. Actually, it sends a very different message to both the workforce, very important point, workforce attitudes to top pay, and the wider community. So I can accept that some of this happens in private, that we don't know about it. From the outside, what it looks like is that no one around the table really objects to these numbers. And that's why bit by bit, they just got bigger and bigger and bigger.
Is there ever a point, Natalie, that you can see people saying, OK, I'm just not going to get paid what I'm worth here, so I've got to go somewhere else?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. When it comes to a salary negotiation, once you're already in the company, there is a huge risk that that will not go well, because there is a high probability that there is a framework around the pay and there isn't the flexibility of the pay increase that the manager would have to make you happy. I guess for someone in a role to get to the point of saying, I need to negotiate it, they most probably feel that they're pretty far out of kilter. I would think anything for up to 7-8%, people most probably tend to, all right. But if they feel it's really out of whack, then they go and have the conversation. But it's rarely that out of whack in a company that is benchmarking themselves and that know what they're able to pay. So that's back to the point. Usually there are other factors that are also not feeling right anymore.
Yes. So I always say to people, before you go and talk about a pay rise, you've got to think, what is your end point? If you don't get it, what are you going to do then?
Correct.
So that you know what your ultimate negotiating position is.
You need to be prepared to walk away. If it's if it's that important to you, you need to be prepared to walk away.
And if you're not prepared to walk away, then you need to think very seriously about how you go about the conversation. Okay. I've always told people, before you go into this, actually, work out what it costs you to live. Because if you know what it actually costs you to live and it costs you to pay your bills and so forth, you will know whether you can afford a period of unemployment while you look for another job. You will know if you can go self-employed. Information about your own personal financial circumstances will have a big impact on whether or not you know what the right money is for you.
What comes next then is, how are you going to have that conversation? Which is another really important factor. Well, that's where the psychology comes in again, isn't it? Because with line manager A, you need to have that conversation completely differently to, you know, line manager B. So if you have got someone who's very kind of proud, very paternal leadership style, you know, some line managers feel offended when people come and ask for more because they feel they're questioning the integrity of the company, you know, and it can blow up a massive relationship issue.
So in fact, you should seek counsel before you go and have that conversation.
I mean, when you think about what's at risk for you, not just financially, but, you know, from a career perspective, I think that's a moment where you benefit from counseling. It can be mentoring, which I think is valuable for anyone through their career. You know, get yourself a couple of good mentors was a huge factor for my career personally.
I wanted to go back to Stefan and ask about the whole idea of, if I don't get this kind of money, I'm going to walk away.
Well, I think the context is everything. I think one thing we haven't talked about yet is contribution. We've been talking inevitably about the money that we get, but of course, people in big jobs, responsible jobs, we want them to make a lasting contribution to the organisation, the health and the sustainability of the business. And that's about not just taking out more than you put in. I mean, this may sound slightly worthy to some people, but there are very big rewards, rightly, for these big, difficult jobs. But we also want people to be making a valuable contribution that you can measure, not just in market terms, but in terms of the development of the people in the business, R&D. May mean facing down some of those short-term pressures that the stock market and others put on you, the media put on you, and wanting instant results. Well, it's complicated. Big organisations are very complicated. You can't change them quickly. So people should perhaps have longer tenures of CEOs and give them a chance, but they should also perhaps not be taking out quite so much over the short term. There's a bit of a mismatch of incentives, priorities and timelines, I think, here.
And do you not think shareholders are influencing that? I mean, my experience of shareholders at every level, so, you know, we do probably in the UK, maybe 30 or 40 senior roles a year. And I would say 3/4 of those have to go to Remco for sign off and approval, even though these are not the CEO jobs. They're in the top maybe 20 people in the company. Yeah. We see a lot of pushback and a lot of alignment over the long term. Mm-hmm. Even so, most of the time you're trying to persuade someone to leave some job and go to another one.
Well, it is interesting that this is happening behind the scenes, and yet I don't think this gets written about, discussed publicly nearly enough. There's not enough transparency. There's not enough disclosure. It's a very good PR trick for some businesses to tell the world a bit more about what they're doing, if that's what's really going on, from the asset manager's point of view too, because again, we get these so-called shareholder springs when enough institutions feel put upon, criticised enough, that there's actually some sort of reputational risk to them. I mean, the 2012 flurry in the end didn't turn out to be that substantial or meaningful. If it had been, why are we having another one in 2016 so soon afterwards? It's complicated. The other thing we haven't talked about yet is, of course, the complexity, sheer complexity of some of these packages. Right, pages and pages and pages. And people are voting on deals, contracts that they don't truly fully understand, because no one can understand them. And then at the end of 3 or 5 years, these fantastic numbers come out the other end of them. And actually, it's embarrassing. It's embarrassing for almost everybody, including the recipient of them. And then you've got a PR problem, and you've got a motivational morale problem also inside the business. And you've got a corporate governance problem, because you've got sort of key risk stuff going on there with one human being. Is there really a succession plan? Is there really a list of 5 names internally who could step up right now? Again, we often don't know. This is often quite murky. I don't think that's good business practice either.
I need to now, of course, especially because Carola is not here, so it's down to me to ask the irreverent questions. So let's start with Stefan. Stefan, can you remember what you earned when you first came to the Financial Times? Can you remember what your starting salary was?
Yes, I can.
Will you share it? Be transparent, in the interest of transparency.
Yeah, I think it was about 50,000 a year.
Right. How long ago was that?
That was 9 years ago.
Right. Do you remember it being a difficult conversation?
No, because I did it just as an athlete says. I went, oh, yes, thank you very much. That's very kind. That sounds very nice. Thank you. When can I start?
So, well, that tells me you really wanted the job.
Yeah, of course. Yes, exactly.
And, of course, this is, as Natalie says, that's where we make our worst negotiation decisions.
Quite.
Tell us about the decision to go to the High Pay Centre.
I just think it's a really interesting topic. It gets you into a nice big discussion about what businesses are for, the ethos and purpose of corporations. It gets you also into the big growing discussion about inequality, income inequality, with radical subversives like the OECD and the IMF saying that inequality is just bad economics, apart from anything else. So I think it's a fascinating time to be in this. And yes, it does allow me to ask some slightly provocative and even perhaps impertinent questions of some very powerful people. But as a hack, I like doing that.
Natalie, when you became a psychologist, did you know that you were going to make a career in talent?
No, because I started my psychology studies really wanting to go into the care sector, partly because that's where I was raised in a way. I wanted to play a part in making people's lives better, so I wanted to be a clinical psychologist. Only through my studies I realized that something like organizational psychology even existed. I didn't even know that was there. And then I got distracted because it was so intriguing, because so much was happening in that field at the time. And there was so much opportunity in organizations in Germany at that point. The big automotives were all collaborating with the university. So during my studies I had access to some of the big, really attractive firms, and there was so much to learn and see that I kind of lost track of what I originally wanted. But I haven't regretted it.
The other thing that obviously people who are listening to the podcast can't see is what we are all wearing. And appearance is something I talk about a lot in my careers books and so on and so on. And I'm delighted Natalie is wearing a block colour jacket, which is actually a trick I've learned from Angela Merkel, actually, is to wear block colour at all times.
Maybe and actually, I've taken that from her without realising.
Yeah. Nicola Sturgeon also does it a lot. Have you noticed
that
too?
That's right, yeah, she does.
It's interesting. When you're going for that pay negotiation, does it matter how you arrive in terms of personal presentation, do you think?
I think personal presentation is really important. I mean, it shouldn't be, but we know it does make a difference. Yeah. People, especially when you're first interviewing, obviously, which where the negotiation starts. You start to put your stall out in the very first conversation that you have. I think that phrase about always dress up one level above what you're doing now, there's something in there. I think you can make an impact through the way you show up, and I think it's important.
Well, I'm also wearing block colour today. But
yeah, I did notice. Nice colour.
I was going to say, I'm really sorry that we're not in the FT studio, because we had planned to be there. It was going to be my first podcast recorded in the FT studio. All my other podcasts have been recorded out in people's workplaces. And I thought we'd try a studio, but instead of which we have got the workplace of the FT's comment editor. This is the nerve centre of what the FT stands for, is here in this office, which I have to say is not very big.
No ego problems.
No ego problems. It's Fred Studeman's office. Ego problems. And he's just calmly saying what the paper thinks about everything from this office.
We could actually seize power. We could have a coup.
We could
get into the computer system and put a completely different paper up.
And have a coup. I think I'm not brave enough to be the comment editor of the Financial Times, I have to say. But thank you very much for being my guest today in this impromptu surroundings.
Excellent.
Thank you so much.
Well, that was really good fun. Great to meet you.
Yes. Natalie, where's your business card?
I would have almost given you an old one from my previous job.
Really, really nice
to meet you. Meet you, Heather.
Yes, right. And lovely to see you. Great. Thank you so much.
Take care.
Thanks a
lot.
Bye.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
Hi. This is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.